What's Always Drink the Good Stuff?
It's about food, art, travel, music, culture, lifestyle. It's interesting conversations with interesting people. And yes, sometimes it's even about drinking the good stuff.
Hello, everybody. I'm really happy to have with us our guest today. She's someone I've known for a very long time. She's one of the first people I met when I got into the wine business. And she's someone who knows wine, and more importantly, someone who knows the wine business. Because without the wine business, knowing wine just becomes a hobby. I'm very happy with us to have with us today, Alison Levine. Alison, welcome to Always Drink the Good Stuff.
Thank you. I feel really old now to say that you've known me as long as you've been in the industry. I'm not that old.
I know you're not. You were in elementary school, I believe, at the time.
Yeah. You just dated me. Okay.
Welcome, Alison.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. As I said, I've known you for a while, and mm-hmm. I always appreciate the things you've done. And you wear, just like me, you wear many, many hats. But before we go into the hats you wear, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Los Angeles. I'm a third generation Los Angelino on both sides of my family.
Wonderful. And was wine part of your family growing up?
Nope, absolutely not. I think I have very vague memories of like my parents drinking like probably like a Kendall Jackson Chardonnay on a special occasion. But no, wine was not something I was familiar with.
Interesting. Mine too. I mean, when I was growing up, the only thing my dad drank was a beer once in a while.
Yeah, my dad drank beer.
Once in a while, on a hot summer day, maybe. That was about it. So you can imagine his chagrin when I got into the wine business.
I don't think anyone really knew it was a business you could get into.
Well, we'll find out sooner or later. What got you into wine?
Ooh, well, I mean, it's a long story and a short story. I mean, I can do it quickly, but I had gone to school. I went to college in Santa Barbara. So, of course, I was sort of introduced to wine there because we would go wine tasting on weekends because it was a fun thing to do.
And it was there.
It was there. It was a 40-minute drive, you know, and we felt so, I don't know, probably with our fake IDs, we just felt so adult. But even then, I didn't know much. In hindsight, I know that I was drawn to the sweet Muscats more than the tannicky Cabernets, but I knew nothing other than, you know, going up to like Fest Parker and having a good time with my friends. And then after college, I was an au pair in Italy, and I lived in a small town or a medium-sized town in Piedmont.
Oh, nice.
Actually the rice capital of Italy, but surrounded by vineyards outside of that. And their wine was just on the table all the time, and that's where I really learned how to drink wine.
With the proper risottos.
Yes, with risottos, with everything. And in hindsight, I know I was drinking Dolcettos and Barberas with occasional Nebbiolos, but I didn't know that. I just didn't have to think about it. I went to dinner, wine was on the table, I drank it, and I was like, oh, that's great. I did fall in love with Brachetto, which I did remember and came home with, but it was really that experience that showed me how wine was part of culture and food. But when I came back to the U.S., it still wasn't in that. So I sort of went about my ways, and I went off to grad school, and I was in D.C., and I saw wine tasting, and I went thinking that would be so much fun, and I left more confused than I had started. I had put a star next to every wine I liked. Couldn't tell you that Chardonnay was a white wine or Cabernet was red. I didn't know anything, and I gave up after that. And then, I told you it was a long story. I moved back to L.A. In 99 to work in the dot-com world. And a friend of a friend taught wine classes as a hobby. And I started going, and I was bit by the bug. And so the more I learned, the more I wanted to know. And when I got laid off from the dot-com bubble in 2001, the original bubble burst, I found myself drinking for a living.
That's wonderful. You know, I'm going to read some of the prep work you've done or background work you've done in the wine world to get you where you are. You have an incredible palate. So.
Oh, well, thank you.
You start a company called Please the Palate.
Yep.
You have a master's degree in international communications. Mm-hmm. You are a WSET3 Level 3 certificate in wine and spirits education.
Yep.
You're an Italian wine specialist.
That's a lofty title.
Yes. You have a certified meeting professional certificate, Bar Smart, Tasting Panel Magazine, Learn About Wine, Chambers M. Chambers. There's a lot going on here. I mean, obviously, you've done your homework. You've been doing your homework over the last two decades.
Yes.
And I know most of these. What's Bar Smarts?
So Bar Smarts was a certification for bar cocktail management. It was, I mean, so many years ago, I can't say I'm an expert in anything with that. But no, it was a certification on cocktails.
Very well. Tell us about, I'm going to go over some of these things because they're very interesting. Because these are all the steps you've taken to bring you where you are today.
Right.
What does Please the Palate do? It's such a... pleasing name, no pun intended.
I started my business 13 years ago, and the idea was my background is marketing, communications, and event planning. I mean, I did that before I got into wine. I was doing that in the tech sector and satellite industry before I kind of came over to this. And so the main bulk of what I do is that it's a small agency that focuses on marketing, communications, and event planning for the wine and spirits industry. But I've tied in everything that I've done in wine, because I've sold wine and I've done education of wine and I've, you know, written about wine and everything. So Please the Palate sort of encompasses everything I do. So marketing and events is working with wine regions around the world to organize mostly industry-related events. I do consumer education. I write about wine. I have a podcast about wine. I've represented and done some brand work for brands. So it kind of encompasses a little of everything. But I think at the bulk of it, it's marketing and education.
And, well, I was going to come back to it later on, but let's talk about that. Interesting right now. You have planned a lot of wine events, whether it's for the trade or for the consumers.
Yes.
And within that, when it comes to the trade or even for the consumers, a lot of foreign wine regions or governmental agencies hire you to plan these events in the United States.
Yes.
Can you tell us what does that work mean? What does it entail?
In planning the events?
Planning events, let's say for an Italian wine region or Spanish wine region or foreign wine region wants to have a introduce their wines or their wine region to the either trade within Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, what have you, or to the consuming public.
Sure.
What does it involve?
Well, I mean, as an event planner, there's a lot of logistical and detailed work, but I like to look at from a big picture of what their goal is. I mean, are they trying to educate people about the region? Are they trying to showcase a certain vintage? What kind of messaging do they want to give? And to understand that messaging in order to communicate that best through the event. I mean, I tend to work on projects more than long-term retainer type things. So I don't have, in these particular events, it's not like I have a say from the start to the finish of how we execute their marketing. But I really try to take what that messaging is to make the event come alive. So it's about finding venues, venues that are going to be well-located, accessible, recognizable, a draw to go to, but not also out of the way. It's hard when you're in big cities to find something central. And it's handling all the details and logistics from venues, staffing, setup, signage, you know, on-site registration, everything. But then I also have a large database of trade and media that I have culled over the years of importers, distributors, sommeliers, retailers, media, educators in major markets around the U.S. And so I'm also responsible for inviting the people and managing them coming and the reminders and the follow-up after the event and try to give a report at the end to just show who came. My goal is not selling wine. That's not my intent per se. It's really the marketing. But I know that's such an important aspect of why these wineries are doing things. They all have their own agendas as why they do events.
And you know, correct me if I'm wrong, the most important part of what you just described is the last component. The people you're going to be inviting to these events. They're the one. Otherwise, a lot of people can put together an event, but if you don't have the relationship with these consumers, with the importers, distributors, retailers, it's a failure. People have to show up to these events for the event to have the appearance of success.
Right, but there's appearance of success by having bodies in the room.
Correct.
And then there's quality. There's quality or quantity.
Correct.
I mean, you can get quantity in a room through many different ways, but it's about quality. It's about getting the right people in the room, because there are a lot of people who love to come for free wine.
Who wouldn't?
But I'm very clear. I vet out these people. I don't need people who are not legitimately in the wine trade, not only because it's not legal. Mm-hmm. I mean, consumers are different.
Right.
You know, it's a different format of that. But I think really with a trade event, it's really about getting, you know, the quality people. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't love when servers and barbacks and busboys come, because they're the future. You just don't know who's in what job today that's going to be in that job tomorrow. But it's really about educating the people who have the decision-making power or will have the decision-making power in the future.
And what would you consider a successful event?
Ooh, when the client's smiling, it's successful for me. When they're happy, when the wineries are happy, I think it's successful. There are a lot of things that determine what's a successful event. I've been doing events for a long time. I'm pretty confident in my ability to have a seamless event. Yes, it's true. Anyone can put on an event. Anyone can order it, but organize it. They can find a venue. They can do it. But, you know, I understand every little detail that's needed, and I can work on a tight budget where you don't have a lot of decor, and I can work on a more extravagant budget. But it's having the nuance for every little detail, making sure everything's right and that everything's been thought of, so that the producers are happy and they don't have questions going, well, if only we'd known this, or this wasn't communicated to us, or we couldn't find this. That, you know, that you're very clear. I try to set standards. I never want to overpromise, but I always want to overdeliver.
And you also, as you just said, you have to manage expectations also.
Yes.
At the same time. And at the same token, then, what do clients feel as a successful event?
When the attendees the participants?
The organizers, the participants, or the organizing region, country, distributor, importer, what they consider a successful event?
Well, I think it's a challenge because I work with a lot of international regions, so they're not as intimately familiar with our markets, right? I mean, if you come to one of my events in Los Angeles and you know the industry in general and you look around the room and you're like, wow, there are some really good buyers here, some good importers, mm-hmm. like there's some key people here, you know that that's a success. The client has to sort of trust that when I give them a report at the end, if they've had engaging conversations with people, if some of the producers say that they actually have orders placed, meetings set up, whatever kind of results-oriented you can get. And, you know, the return on investment, the ROI on these events are very – it's hard to quantify the ROI because articles can come out, but they may come out a day later, a week later, a month later, a year later.
Right.
Purchases can happen, but that purchase may not be just because someone came to the event, but it started a conversation or it was part of a continuing conversation. So the event, to me, especially when it's a wine region, is really about, for when I'm doing trade events, I look at it as an opportunity for the trade to come in and see a snapshot of what is happening right now in the region. Hopefully the region will come back over and over. But if you're talking about a wine region, so take any region in Italy or Spain or whatever, where they focus on particular grape varieties, or it's all about value wines, or it's about bulk wines, or it's about whatever, you can look at what a vintage is or vintages are giving you at a time. For you as an importer, you might have a wine already in your portfolio from that place, but maybe you can come and see where that wine is. Mm-hmm. In relation to what's else in the market. Like, do you have the best value you can get? Did you taste something else that was better quality? And so, you know, I think that's what people should get out of these events. And then, you know, hopefully you see that investment, the return on investment down the line.
I remember attending one of your events for Spanish wines a few years back. And that's when we started importing some of our wines from Ribera del Duero. And we did that for a few years. So it was as a result of meeting some winery owners mm-hmm. during one of your events.
But again, that probably started a conversation. You didn't walk in, taste the wine, and go, okay, I'm importing
you
today.
No, of course not. Yeah. Excuse me. No, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that started the conversation. We went back and forth, and then we decided what to bring. So that's when it started.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they were happy for being here. So that, I mean, a lot of these things go back to your reputation as someone who's, who has a good reputation in the wine industry, who puts on these reputable, legitimate events for the trade, and people see results sooner or later. Because it's not something, you're not going to go there and just give them a PO.
Yeah.
You're just going to go there and start a conversation, taste the wines, and build on that relationship.
Yeah. And, you know, I do, depending on what the region is, I'll do anything from a seminar, a small event like a lunch, a food pairing, to really show how the wines pair with food, which puts your mindset in a different way because you see the wines in a different light. But when you have 30 or 40 wineries from one region coming, there aren't a lot of ways you can showcase them except a walk around tasting.
Exactly. Exactly. And you leave it up to the attendees to pace themselves and taste whatever they want to talk to, whoever they want to talk to.
Exactly.
How is that different from a tasting for the consumer, for the public?
I mean, in some ways, it's the same thing, except for a consumer. For consumer, a really good consumer event, the consumer wants to learn. How much they want to learn or what they're learning, you know, is up to the individual. But I think that, you know, these tastings offer opportunities to explore wine. And maybe you're a fan of Pinot Noir and you go to a Pinot Noir event, and that's great for a consumer to explore something they know. But then you go to something you're not familiar with. It introduces you to new grapes or new places. And so I think, you know, I always consider myself coming to this as a consumer, a student of wine, and I kind of came into it as a consumer. So for me, I'm always trying to learn and taste new things. So, you know, I look for those opportunities, and that's how I approach doing a consumer event in general.
Well, one of the main differences, of course, is that the consumers have to pay to come to these events, whereas the trade don't.
True.
But here's a one of my observations. Tell me if I'm right or wrong. Excuse me. I have participated in many of these, in all kinds of wine tasting events, and we have participated as vendors and in these tastings as well. Halfway through the tasting, you get to see the same people over and over again coming in, just pour me whatever.
Right.
They just want to get drunk after that point.
Yeah, they want their money's worth.
Right. It's so funny. I mean, it happened last Sunday as well. And just that after a while, you get to see the same people over. Oh, I really love that wine. Let me have some more.
Let me have a little more. Yeah. You know, I mean, with consumer events, I mean, I do a monthly wine, you know, non-committal wine club. I'm promoting small direct-to-consumer wineries, like boutique wineries in California. And, you know, we do a virtual tasting and really get people's attention. And I find that, you know, when people are on the virtual, like, these are people, they want to listen. They learn the story of the winemaker. They listen how they made the wine. They taste the wine as they're talking about it. And in the end, we open it up to questions. And it's always, I mean, we all have questions throughout the time where people are typing them in. But at the end, you know, we're just like a free-for-all off mics. And it's great to see how much people have been able to connect and ask questions and want to know more. So, yes, big walk-around tastings are a little more of a drunk fest, inevitably.
But, you know, person who's on a Zoom call, that person really wants to learn.
Yes, yes.
They made a commitment already.
Yes.
To be there, to have the sample sent to them. And they're sitting there for an hour and listening and learning, paying attention. And listening to the details, the nuances. But the walk-arounds are a little bit different. I get that.
But, you know that I created an event this year that I'm working on for next year called the Festival of Forgotten Grapes.
Yes.
And not that I'm doing a shameless plug here.
That's very interesting to me. Please talk about it. I was going to bring that up. You brought it up. You must be reading my mind.
Well, but I was going to say the thing about this event is not just what our theme and our focus is on the event, but it's really one of the things that I thought is missing from most consumer events.
And it's called again, please?
The Festival of Forgotten Grapes.
Okay, what is the idea behind it?
So the idea about the Festival of Forgotten Grapes, it is in California. There are 9 grapes that make up 93% of what is planted here. Mm-hmm. And this is an event celebrating the 100 other varieties that make up only 7% of what is planted in the entire state of California. So,
and you're focusing on California grown.
On California, although we may have one or two importers doing some forgotten grapes from other countries. But like, a Nebbiolo is forgotten here in California because there's little planted. A Nebbiolo is not forgotten in Italy. It is right. A primary grape. So,
but let's face it, though, California Nebbiolo is not going to have much of a demand here.
No, but there are some very, very good ones.
Are there?
Yes.
Okay.
You have to come to the event to see.
I will.
No, there are some wonderful producers. But I think that what's interesting about the forgotten grapes is we're catering, obviously, to a particular audience, people who are who like wine, who are curious, people who want to explore, people who want to learn something different. They may be familiar with some of the grapes, introduced to others. Some of these grapes are not unknown to people who have traveled around the world because they're Spanish grapes, Italian grapes, French grapes, German grapes. They're just, they're not the big names that people drink every day or you see on every wine list. But the event is one thing, but I think what's really unique about our event is what is missing from a lot of events out there, which is we have a retail component. And
that's smart.
But what I say about that is that it's a twofold. Like, I have a retail license because of the wine club that I have. So this is why I can do it. Because I've done events in the past where I've partnered with a retailer, which is a great way to do it. But then that retailer has to carry every single wine. So if you partner with anything from a BevMo to a little local retailer, they're going to have to buy in the wines as right. people order them. And when they do that, because they buy through the wholesaler, through the distributor, they have to buy in case buys or they have to pay a fee for breaking those cases. Because of the license I have, which is an online license, we have people order what they want, mix and match, and we're able to buy the wines directly from the winery. And they don't ship them. We hand deliver so that we are able to eliminate a lot of the costs
right.
to keep costs down for the consumer. But also, you know, make it something fun. Because if each winery were to take their own orders, that's great for the one winery that gets the orders.
Right.
But usually someone falls in love with your wine. They order a case because you've given them some discount for ordering a minimum amount. And by the time they get to the 10th table, they're like, oh, I've already bought 3 cases of wine. I'm tapped out for the day. And at our event, we're saying to people, have fun. Buy 2 bottles from this person, 6 from that, 1 from that, 1 from that. If you end up at the event with 3 bottles of wine purchased, great. If you end up with 3 cases of wine, great. You know, it really is an individual thing of what you want with no obligations of minimums or,
no, that's very smart. I also, that creates a relationship between you and the customers as well. They get to know you as the source for those wines.
Right.
And if they want to buy again later on,
they go to the winery. No, they go to the winery.
Oh, okay.
We
okay.
send it right off to the winery.
Okay, it's a win-win.
You know, I mean, the goal is to make this a win-win for everyone, for the consumer, but also for the winery, to maybe introduce new customers who, yes, some wineries have said to me, oh, I might sell more if I sold direct. And I'm like, yeah, you might get 1 person or 2 people who order a case of wine.
Right.
But if you get 6 people that order a bottle, that's 6 new customers you might be able to reach out to in the future mm-hmm. and offer your wine club or offer right. a special or invite them to do something, you know, and make them a long-term customer.
It's part of their client acquisition.
Exactly.
Process.
Exactly.
So what were some of the really unusual varietals that you had, you were offering that day?
Well, we had two producers doing Assyrtiko, domestic
really?
Assyrtiko,
okay.
which I thought was pretty interesting.
Was one of them from Santa Barbara area?
One of them was
Greek family there. That
Paso Robles.
Are they from Paso Robles?
Yeah.
The Greek family.
Yeah, Boots family wise.
Yes, yes, I met them actually. A good
yes.
father and son.
Yes, yes, they have an Assyrtiko.
I've tried actually.
And then I'm trying to think who else had our other Assyrtiko, and I'm blanking on it. But yes, we had 2, which is having one is weird enough,
right.
but 2. We had Toraldigo. We had a producer in Bakersfield doing a Ruque, which is a Piemontese. It's a Piemontese red grape, delicious wine. And they had Ruque. It's an obscure grape in Piedmont.
Okay.
So even more obscure here. But we also had wineries like Vega Vineyard in Santa Barbara and Giornata in Paso Robles and Tansy in Sonoma that focus exclusively on Italian varieties in their wine production.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of producers that do Rhone grapes because Syrah is not a forgotten grape, but Grenache, Viognier, Roussan, Marsan, Claret Blanche, Bourblanc, Piquepoul, all forgotten grapes.
Really?
Yeah.
Grenache as well?
Well, I don't have the California Acreage Report right in front of me, but in general, there's something like 20,000 or 40,000 acres of Syrah planted, and there's 4,500 acres of Grenache.
Wow.
So,
interesting. I would understand peak pool.
Yeah. And we are talking because there's something like 90,000 acres of Chardonnay, I believe, or something like that. And it's like 120 acres of Cinsault. Oh, wow. You know, so I mean, you really, forgotten grapes, you know.
Most of them are probably in Central Coast area, right?
Lodi is a mecca for them,
really?
Which is technically Central. Right. I guess.
Yeah, it's in more inland, yes.
But Lodi is a mecca for them. There's a lot of them in...
Because of the heat?
I think partially for the heat, but also there are some climates that get high elevation, so you get some cooler areas. The Mokelumne River, if I said that correctly, is a little more lifted. So you have a lot of these forgotten grapes, plus you have old vines, like old vines and so, and growing there. San Ynez Valley has a good amount of them, especially because there's, you know, around the Ballard, Los Olivos area of all the Rhone varieties.
Correct.
So, you know, that's producing it. But there's a lot of Grüner Veltliner now coming. I mean, a lot is a relative term, right?
Comparatively.
I mean, there's now like 5 acres of Grüner Veltliner in San Ynez, but there used to be 2. So, I mean, it's growing. And then I'm trying to think some of the other really interesting varieties. There's, you know, Gamay. Again, these are not like, oh, I've never heard of it. Where is it from? But you just don't see it a lot. And the great thing at the event is we have a lot of smaller producers, people who are making, you know, they're mostly direct-to-consumer, if not exclusively, wineries. But we also have some bigger wineries there. We have Robert Hall from Paso Robles that comes to the event, and they're coming back. But what's interesting is you might know Robert Hall for its Sauvignon Blanc and its Cabernet.
Right.
The only time you're going to taste their Carignan or their Grenache Blanc is if you go to the tasting room, and you may not know to ask about those unless you know about it, because you're going to go for the varieties you know. So, you know, a lot of these wineries have, anytime you go wine tasting, you can ask them, what's your most obscure grape that you have or your most random thing to pour? And you'd be surprised, a lot of wineries have these little gems that they're like, oh, well, we made a little bit of this and...
And it's interesting also, you and I are talking right now, and we're in the business, so we know a lot about these, more about these good varietals,
right,
where the average wine consumer may not necessarily know what Gamay is, or they, or the other, some of the other varietals that, which sound very familiar to me,
yes,
but they're not familiar to the consumer.
Right, and so the great thing, and the feedback we got from the first event, was that people loved tasting these vines. Some varieties they knew, some they didn't know, but they were introduced to things. But, you know, I had a friend even say to me at the end of the event, she called me afterwards, and, you know, I think of her as more of like a spicy tequila cocktail person than a wine person.
Uh-huh.
And she bought a few bottles of wine, and she's like, I bought red wines. And I said, that's great. She goes, I didn't think I liked red wine.
Wow,
and I said, really? You didn't? She goes, but I tasted these wines, and they were really good. And I said, because you tasted some lighter-bodied reds or some more, you know, interesting reds that appeal to you, and you're used to going to a restaurant where the only thing you do is like, a big fruit-driven, you know, like a Cabernet, and maybe that's not your style.
Right.
And it's great for the people that it is, but there are so many other grapes out there. So the minute someone says, I don't like this, I'm like, but there are so many other grapes that you just need to explore.
That's the key. You got to have an open mind and explore. And that's what I like about attending these events, because I'm offering them something new, something different. A lot of people, when I go to a lot of these Armenian wine tasting events, they say, do you have Cabernet? I go, well, no, we don't have a Cabernet, but
we have Areni, 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 and another Areni.
And so on. And why don't you try it? And as there are different styles of Cabernet, there are different styles of Areni, different from some appellations, from different winemakers, different altitudes. So each one is going to have a different expression of the wine.
Right.
And you just have to stand there, enjoy them, and keep an open mind. That's the beauty of going to these wonderful events.
Yeah, and one of the things I would say to any wine drinker who doesn't think of themselves as that knowledgeable, I mean, sometimes the most knowledgeable people, the people who think they know the most, have a very limited palate. They know what they like, and they drink that, and that's great. You know what you like.
Right.
But I think what's really fun is to kind of know what you like, but be able to describe it, not by grape per se, but describe what you're liking. Do you like the mouthfeel? Do you like the high acidity? Do you like the juiciness? Do you like the jamminess? And then look at where it's from. to get in, to take that, because you can take that into a wine store or a restaurant and say, well, I typically drink a really fruit-forward, jammy wine, and I tend to drink a lot from Paso Robles. What else do you recommend? And they might say, oh, well, you know, you should try this from, you know, this region, or try this grape, because if you like this, you might like that. And just always be open. And if you come back and say, you know, I always love when someone says, I don't drink Chardonnay, and I'm like, I am going to convert you, because the one ultimatum I say in wine is that there are no ultimatums. You cannot make an ultimatum in wine.
Exactly. You probably don't want to drink the buttery Chardonnay, which...
Yeah, but not all Chardonnay are buttery.
Correct, exactly.
And the minute you say, you know, I don't like this, it's like...
Wait a second.
Now, you can say, I don't prefer this, but...
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's very interesting. We see the WSET label around. Many people carry that as part of their title. Can you explain to us what that is?
The Wine and Spirits Education Trust is a
certification. What does that do?
It's a certification with different levels out of the UK, out of London. It's a great program. When I was looking for certifications, you know, sort of the two main paths you can take is the sommelier path or the WSET path. And since I don't work in restaurants and I don't work on the floor of restaurants, the biggest difference between the two is the sommelier one has a service aspect that WSET does not. And as I do education and events and writing, the WSET certification seemed more appropriate for what I was doing. So I did my level, they didn't even offer level one back when I did it long before, but level one is so introductory. Level two I did a long time ago, where I drove down to Newport Beach every Saturday for 6 weeks because that's the only place it was being offered at the time. And then I kind of sat on that for a while. And then a few years ago, before COVID, I got the impetus to do, you know, my level three. And then during COVID, I toyed with going for my diploma, but then I decided not to.
How difficult is the level three?
That's a hard thing to say. I've been working
on it. It's very difficult. I know you're in the business. You've been tasting wine.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if you do level one and level two, level three, it's work, but it's not, you know... It's hard and it's work, but it's not impossible. But, you know, I have the advantage of working in wine and tasting, but I always laugh because in WSET, because of the British bent, they tend to have an affinity to certain regions over others. And I have an affinity for the small guys and the little guys, and I tend to drink wines from other regions. So, you know, while it would behoove me to really know my Australian Napa and Bordeaux wines, you know, while I was doing my studies, I was going down to Valle de Guadalupe, Mexico, and going to Greece. And I'm like, well, they don't really cover those in depth.
They feel probably
depth.
More Bordeaux and Burgundy.
Yeah. I mean, it's little sections. But it's a great education. I know a lot of non-industry people who have done WSET 1, 2, and even 3 and get really excited about it. I think having that base of knowledge just... You know, we always say that we want to simplify wine, and I don't want to complicate it for people. I'm not trying to make it a pretentious thing in the least. But I do think that with a little bit of information, it can take you so much further. And what that information is really at your own pace, but just knowing, not the wrong information, but just having, if you understand how wine is made, you know, then you understand the choices winemakers make. Then when you taste a wine, you start to put into context what you tend to like, or what you seem to always be drawn to. And it gives context, which means when you go to a restaurant, you get excited to try things because you're like, you know, I've had this. But, you know, if you don't have that little bit of knowledge, you don't get excited when you look at a wine list. You're just like, I don't know, I'll have a Cabernet to go with my oysters.
Yes. No, that's when a good sommelier wine steward comes into play to make suggestions based on what they're ordering.
Right.
And that's wonderful. as we mentioned earlier, you have a Italian wine specialization also.
I think I have a little affinity because I spent some time there.
Right.
So.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about Italy. I love Italian wines. And where are some of your? What's your favorite wine region in Italy?
It's hard to say. I have a favorite. That's the hardest thing to ask someone in wine. What's your favorite thing? Okay. So, I mean, that's like
top three.
Okay. I mean, I have a very special affinity to Piemonte, not only because they make incredible wines, but that's really where I cut my teeth on wine. Okay. And yes, I love a wonderful Nebbiolo. I love Dolcetto and Barbera. But like I said, my first love is Brachetto, which is a slightly sweet, slightly effervescent red wine. It just stole my heart.
Okay.
It reminds me of roses and strawberries, and it goes with chocolate. It's perfect. But also, they have so many, like, indigenous unknown grapes. There's Ruque, Green Yolino. You have, I'm going to start throwing up all my other grapes from other regions, but you have just all these Pellaverga. You have so many wonderful grapes to explore in this region that just, you know, are forgotten grapes of the region that are being revitalized now and producers. I love Sicilian wine. That's probably, mm-hmm. you know, another incredible place to explore the indigenous right. grapes, the Cararato and Caracante, and just Nero's. Love it. Yeah. I mean, just, you know, Frappato. I mean, just wonderful grapes. They're fun to say too. But you know, it's hard to say, you know, exploring anywhere else. I had great wines when I was in Umbria, and I want to explore more of that. I love the wines of, I love the sparkling wines of Italy, which come from all over, from Franciacorta, you know, the Veneto with great Proseccos, right. Alta Langhe, Trentadoc. You have so many great sparkling wines coming out of Italy. I mean, it's just hard to narrow it down to one thing. I'm an equal opportunist.
Well, that's one of the beauties of wine. You get so much out there.
Yeah.
So many great wines, so many great sub-appellations, sub-regions of wines to choose from.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so wonderful, so rich, such a worthwhile experience and hobby and business.
Absolutely. Exploring the world of wine.
Exactly. Well, how about let's have some French, or what are some of your favorite French wine regions?
You know, I have less, I've spent some time in France, but not enough. So, I mean, of course, Champagne. I've been there for one day, but it is my goal to go back and spend more time. I had a goal to get to Champagne and touch the chalk walls, and I did it. But
do you think Champagne is not underrated, but underutilized? Or not too many people think of Champagne as an everyday drinking wine, that rather think of it as celebratory wine?
Yeah, but I think that all sparkling wine is seen as celebratory and not everyday. I opened up a bottle of sparkling wine for dinner last night.
Wonderful.
Because why not?
Exactly.
You know, I thought it would go well with what I was eating. So
there you go.
No, I think Champagne. I think Champagne is great. Obviously, I'm a Burgundy fan. I love Gamay from Beaujolais. I love, you know, the wines of the Rhone Valley, Languedoc. I mean, again, I guess the only place I'm Bordeaux and Chianti are like the two main regions I haven't mentioned in either country. I like the wines, but my heart is a little more towards these more earth-driven, okay. high-acid wines.
And how about in Spain?
Oh, Spain. I have to spend more time in Spain on the wine side.
Okay.
I mean, I love the Garnachas. Castilla.
Castilla León.
No. It'll come to me. I'm just having a blank. Okay. But I just love the Garnachas.
Okay. I remember I've been to many parts of Spain.
Uh-huh.
North, south, central.
Oh, Catalan wines.
Okay, Catalan.
The Catalan wines, of course, Ribera del Duero, but yes.
Right. I've been to many parts of Spain. When you're traveling, you just, especially when you're in big cities like Barcelona or Madrid, unless you go to a like specialized wine store or a wine restaurant, you see many of the okay, great, not super wine, but okay wine on the shelves, by which they tend to taste better there while you're on vacation than they do here. And I've tested this theory many, many times. A regular Bordeaux will taste much better in Paris than it does here.
It's probably the time, the weather, your mentality.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, there's a context for every wine in every place.
You're
yeah.
enjoying yourself.
You're less critical.
Correct, correct. But, you know, last year I had the opportunity to travel with a couple of three other wine friends. We started in Champagne, drove down to Burgundy, and then drove to Barolo. Mm. We covered these three cities in about 14 days, and it was a phenomenal, phenomenal wine trip.
Yeah, you probably ate well and drank well.
Oh, phenomenal, yes. There's nothing like it. There was like some amazing wines, amazing food, amazing cities, towns, villages. It was a phenomenal, phenomenal trip.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I look at wine as, I think that everyone finds a way to look to there are people who are students of history. Some people study history through, you know, actual the history of wars and everything else. And some people do art history and some people do literature as ways to understand that. And when I was in college, I was a film studies major studying the history of film, but it was also a reflection of what was happening in society at the time, both in how film was developed and how the industry was developed, but also how it reflected society at the time between wars and depressions and everything. And when I found wine, wine kind of fit that hole for me, that it filled that part of the, because I wanted to be a cross-cultural trainer and I studied international communications, and it's this understanding different cultures and understanding history, but wine is that story. It connects so much because what's in that bottle represents so much more. It's what the winemaker did. It's what the vintage told you, but it's also the history, like the vines, the region, the food you have with it. So
that's very, very true. I mean, every time I open it, like older vintage bottle, let's say, mm-hmm. I think about what was going on during that year.
Yeah.
What were some of the events happening in Italy or France or California, and how that wine has stood the test of time. And now it's a beautiful expression of that fruit that mm-hmm. that winemaker thought about when they were making the 70s, 60s, 80s, whenever it
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
It's just so wonderful. And that's what I like about it. It's a living organism, and you're enjoying something that was made 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it tastes better than you ever thought it would.
Absolutely.
Because it represents something that I love and I enjoy. And the best part for me is when I'm sharing it with people who equally appreciate what's in that bottle.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, like, you know, an artist, when they produce something, obviously it's great when they sell it, but they don't know where their art's going to be in 20 right. years, 50 years, or 100 years, in whose home or in what art gallery, wherever it is. And someone is, they can't even predict who's going to be looking at their art and what impact it'll have. And I'm sure the person who bottled that wine in 1973 had no idea if, I mean, they might have had aspirations, right. but they had no idea if someone would open up a bottle in 2025 or if it would all be drunk or... Like, you know, they have no idea. Yeah,
I mean, that's why the story is so as important as the wine itself, especially when you're selling wine.
Right.
You got to have a good story to tell.
Absolutely.
About where that bottle was, how that bottle became, how that winemaker, that vineyard got together to make that wine. And it's the same with art.
Yeah.
You gotta have a good story to tell and yeah. a good wine.
Same for writing about wine. Right. I mean, you've got to tell a story. And, I mean, nobody cares about.
Which brings me to my point. You also do a lot of writing.
I do.
What are some of the things you write about? I know it's about wine, but more specifically, where do you write? Who do you write for? And what are some of the things you write about?
Well, I write about wine and wine travel and wine life and wine and food. I have a blog under Please the Palate. So I do a wine of the week every week where I feature different wine and talk about what I drank it with food-wise and, you know, a little bit about the winery. And I always love to explore, like, how I pick a wine of the week is really about something interesting that drew me to that wine as to, mm-hmm. you know, either I was out somewhere and got to taste it or, you know, I have it at home and enjoyed it. And then I write for a site called winetraveler.com, so more wine tourism. So these will be more kind of regional stories of where to go, why to go there, and mm-hmm. what to do when you're there. I write for a site called California Wine Advisor, so that's the same sort of idea, but it's about wineries in California. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, one-offs for other people. I've written for the Vintner Project. I write for the Somm Journal and Tasting Panel magazines, which are more trade-focused, and Beverage Industry News. Those are trade publications, right. So...
How big is wine traveling or wine travels for people to travel to go to wine destinations? How big is that? What industry is that?
I don't know the numbers, but I think it's a great medium through which one could travel. You know, I think that wine and food is your sort of, you know, focus on any trip. I mean, how does food not end up being a focus on any trip? No matter where someone goes, they always come back and talk about the food they ate. So, you know.
And if you're into wine, all the wine you drank.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it's great to, you come back from a trip and you talk about, you know, the beautiful architecture you saw, the old village you saw, and the food you ate. I mean, that's always what happens. So, you know, you just throw wine in there as that added experience. And to what you said, it's about sharing with friends and culture, and you learn so much about a place when you kind of see how wine plays a role in life there.
And how what kind of role it had played over time.
Right.
And which really, really gets you going and learn about wanting to learn, because in a lot of these wine regions, wine was the industry that brought the town, made it, became what it is today because of wine business, wine trade, buying and selling vineyards, and all these things that came to over time that made them what they are today.
I always have this joke when I'm traveling to Italy, but in Europe, when I'm there and some, you know, you get a little water and you'll have a glass and they pour you this much water. And I'm like, I'm an American, please fill up my glass. Like, I drink water. Right. And they always give you this much water. You have to ask for water. You never have to ask for wine.
No.
They always fill up your glass with wine, but water you have to beg and plead for more than like two sips.
Right. And I also have to ask for ice.
Yeah, they don't believe in ice.
Right. What's the most satisfying part of your job?
I don't know. I'm satisfied when I know that that people are happy with what I've done. I guess I feed off that. So if the client's happy with an event, if the feedback of attendees is positive, if someone read an article and says something nice, just knowing, not because it's like, oh, you know, I feel so good about myself, because it means that I got through to someone somehow. Right. You know, maybe that little bit of passion I have like spread onto someone else just a little bit and intrigue them.
Because for me, there are two parts to, for me, first, discovering a new vineyard, a new winery, a new region, and having the experience of tasting the wines that are coming out of there. And equally, sometimes even more so, is when I make a suggestion to someone, try this wine or buy this bottle of wine, and they come back to me and say, oh, we loved it.
Yeah.
I love that. It means that I made a difference
in
opening up their mind, their palate, teaching them something new, offering them a new something new for them to try. And I love that. I get sort of gratification out of that.
Yeah. And again, you know, consumer is a little different than trade, because with trade, you know, I want a client to be happy. I want them to feel that their money was well spent and that they got what they wanted out of that event, whatever that is, you know, whether it's the quality of attendees, the number of attendees, the wines showed beautifully, whatever that is.
Right.
On the flip side, with consumer, it is about, you know, can that, you know, sort of wine bug that bit me so long ago, can I spread that? Just can I help someone else find that, where they just get a little excited, you know? Like, I remember sitting at a dinner once. I was on a press trip to Germany, to the Mosel, and we were having dinner, and it was at Ernie Lohsen's house, which was a treat enough, but I'll never forget. I mean, it was a wonderful experience for me, but we had a Trockenbaron Auslesen, which is a very sweet wine paired with, like, it was a date wrapped with bacon or something like that. And it was just a wonderful pairing. And there was a young woman from the PR team who tasted it and just had a reaction, because it was her very first aha moment, you know, and everyone kind of remembers their first aha moment of that food and wine pairing that just transcends anything else, that you don't have words for it. But once you have it, you're always aspiring to find another one of those. And we sat there and we watched her, and she had no words. She was just like, she was so kind of touched by this experience, and it was an amazing pairing. And that's what I hope everyone can always have, is that experience where they just don't have words for it, but they know that they want to go after it to find it again.
New discovery.
Yeah.
Similarly, a few weeks ago, I came across this Georgian Merlot.
Ooh.
I was amazed by it. I took it to some wine people that were gathering afterwards. I put it in a brown bag.
Uh-huh.
And I poured it to about five different people who are in the wine business. They all loved the wine, but they couldn't figure out what it was. And these are seasoned wine professionals. It had masked itself by the terroir, by the Cavalry aging.
Uh-huh.
It was so different. Yet it was a Merlot grown in Kakheti, Georgia.
Wow.
It was so wonderful. They all were all blown away when I tore up the bag. I mean, that's a discovery moment. You know,
absolutely.
You don't expect it.
Absolutely. That's what's fun about wine.
I got the suggestion of Pinot. I got the suggestion of Grenache. Nobody bothers saying Merlot.
Yeah. Merlot. People forgot about Merlot.
I think it's coming back, but nevertheless.
No, but I think that's the really beauty of wine and just getting people to have fun and explore. And again, somebody who knows nothing about wine that you put your favorite Pinot Noir or Georgian Merlot in front of, and they're not going to get excited because they're kind of like, you know, that's not maybe the first wine you want to introduce someone to. But once they develop their palate by tasting different things. It's really about tasting.
Right.
That's how you develop. It's not, you don't have to go study it. You just have to taste a lot and then kind of remember what you liked and didn't like and what that was.
And that evolves over time. How has your palate changed over time?
So I'm pretty lucky because, like I said, when I first started in Santa Barbara, I was going for sweet wine. Sweet is always what beginners start with.
Right.
It's the most palatable, the most enjoyable, easy, balanced sweetness.
Right.
I still like a good sweet wine as long as it's balanced with lots of acidity. But I was very lucky because I cut my teeth in Piedmont, where the wines are very acid driven and not over the top fruit. And so it's funny because I had coffee with my old boss when I sold wine for Chambers and Chambers just this morning. And it was funny because I said, you know, 20 years ago, I remember sitting down with him when he wanted to interview me for a job to sell wine. Wow. And he said to me, your palate is like here, it's high, but your knowledge is not where your palate is.
Wow, okay.
But he said, I remember him telling me, I can catch your knowledge up to your palate, but it takes longer to get to where you are. Right. But I was lucky because I learned in Piedmont. And then when I was doing the wine education business, I was with people so much more advanced with great palates. So the wines that I got when I went to dinner with them, I was drinking great wines. I was drinking Burgundies and, you know, Rieslings, German Rieslings, and all these great wines. And I developed my palate around them. And then over the years, I've developed my vocabulary and knowledge to match that. So, you know, it's just always about exploring. But, you know, I've been pretty lucky that I've been on a sort of a acid path in my wine love all along, because acidity is good for aging and it's good for food pairing.
Yes, it is. I started getting into wine when I was at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
We would buy these $2 dollar Chiantis that came in these craft bottles.
Uh-huh. You're dating yourself now.
Yes, I am.
Because when afterwards you put a candle in and
right,
you let them.
Right. Well, I didn't do that, but and then I had some friends who were really, really into Napa Valley Cabernets. And I started drinking Napa Cabs. But since then, my taste buds have evolved, where right now I drink mostly older vintages of French and Italian wines. So there's a lot more acid. I love the acid right now. And so my taste buds have... and that's what happens when you drink over time. I think you evolve. Your taste buds evolve.
Well, when you start to... your taste buds do evolve, but it's also about what pairs with food. Like when you realize you don't want your wine to compete with your food any more than you want your food to compete with your wine. It's like adding spices things. So when you find those wines that are just sort of, you know, easily paired with food, oh my God, it's easy. You don't have to think too hard, you know.
Absolutely. When I go to restaurants in Los Angeles Valley, whatever, I always take my wine with me. and I'm happy to pay corkage. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
I have a lot of wine at home that I can't seem to get through. So I'm always happy to drink with people and share. But I usually order from the winery, from the restaurant list, but it depends on where I'm going. I feel that a lot of restaurants, the time that the wine director sommelier has put into crafting a wine list, if it's a good wine list, I want to explore their wine list. Now, if I have a very special bottle, a unique bottle, a rare bottle that I want to open, whether it's some, you know, I brought a few wines home from when I went to the Republic of Georgia, so I want to find a good excuse to bring that. If I have like an old Pinot Noir that I want to open up or something like that, I can see paying corkage, and I'm not opposed to paying corkage, but it really, you know, is about like what the restaurant already has to offer. You know, if I'm going to a restaurant that doesn't have a lot of wines and it's going to be, you know, have a little more spice to it, yeah, I'm going to probably bring a wine from home that I think will pair. But if the restaurant has done their job well, I want to explore what they've done.
Well, that's the key. Do you think a lot of restaurants in LA have done their job well when it comes to wine?
It's different. I mean, you have to kind of look at like what kind of dining experience you're having. I mean, if you're going into these restaurants that have sommeliers where, you know, unfortunately you're spending 150 or more a person at this rate, the way things are, yeah, I expect something off those wine lists. And I think a lot of restaurants have done a great job. And I know a lot of great sommeliers in this city and other cities who have crafted some really interesting wine lists. I love the wine list where you go in. I love a wine list that nothing's familiar, especially when nothing's familiar even to myself and my friends who know a little bit about wine. But I also like a restaurant that can give you some familiarity, but really confuse you. So they can have Chardonnay, but it's not from places you're familiar with. They can have, you know, maybe grapes you know from places you're not familiar with, or places you know with grapes you're not familiar with, just to make you kind of think a little bit about what you're doing.
To me, most of the time I'm going to restaurants in the Valley. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the wine lists at the restaurants are catering to certain type of clientele who want to drink the fruit forward Cabernet from Paso.
Well, then they're not doing their job.
No. That's why I choose the restaurant based on the food they're serving.
And then bring your wine.
And then I bring my wine.
That makes sense.
I have a lot more, it balances better for me because I appreciate the food they're serving.
Right.
And as I said, I have no problem paying for the corkage, but I want to enjoy the wine because for me, the wine is more important than the food. As long as the food is good and I'm doing the pairing myself,
right,
it works great for me.
Yeah. No, I agree with you in a case like that. And I think there are a lot of smaller restaurants around town. And I think, unfortunately, there are, I don't want to be a bad word, but there are lazy somms or lazy buyers, or maybe they're not lazy. There are less dedicated people to that job now. And it's very easy to let a salesperson come in and sort of direct where to go, especially when they have those key brands that people are familiar with. Right. And as long as people, you know, what familiarity is a comfort place. I get it. You know, you walk in, you recognize that Chardonnay on the list, you're going to order it. But, you know, there's so much more. And like you said before, there's a story behind everything. So sometimes there are stories you might not like to know about a brand.
Right.
There are stories you might not like to know about how a wine is made if you really took the time to look at some of these brands. I know there are some articles going around about how much sugar is in certain large, well-known brands. And, you know, a lot of people don't think about that. And if they really thought about the Mega Purple being added or
most people don't know what that is, by the way.
Yeah, grape concentrate, but it adds color and it adds sweetness.
Right,
but you know, I mean, you know, that's why it's kind of interesting to have someone that works in the restaurant who can, you know, turn you on to something. And it doesn't have to be a weird wine they turn you on to, just maybe something that you're not familiar with producer-wise.
And as I'm sure you are, when I'm at a restaurant with some friends, I'm the one who gets handed the wine list.
Yeah, most of the time. Except when I go with wine people. And then it's
If I'm with wine people, I defer it to them.
Me too.
Because I want to learn something new. I want to see what their thinking is.
Yes, exactly.
And that's what makes the whole evening fun, because we spend half the time talking about the wine and what we think about it and what the next bottle is going to taste like.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's your whole conversation. But no, I mean, it's actually interesting.
It is. It is wonderful.
You know, I have a lot of friends that work in different fields, and I think what they do is very interesting. But I can tell you that 9 out of 10 times that I go to dinner with a group of friends, nobody's asking the lawyer to tell more about their work. Nobody's asking the teacher. My friend who's a therapist might get a few questions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, are you analyzing me? Can you help me? Whatever. Even though that's not what she does. But everybody wants to talk about wine, and they don't necessarily need to talk about me. They're not necessarily asking me to talk about me, but they're talking about wine. Their wine travels, their experiences, right. What they tasted, what they like, what they buy, where they went. And it makes a conversation.
Because, I mean, that's what makes it interesting for them. It's new for them. Or it's, they're not very familiar with it.
Yeah.
And it, from the outside, it looks wonderful, and it is wonderful. But a lot of people don't realize it's still a business.
Yes.
It's still a business. You have to run a business. I was talking to some people the other day. She goes, oh, you know, it's so wonderful. You get to travel a lot. I said, yes, I do. But I still have to run a business.
Yes.
Which I love doing as well.
Yes, I still have to do my accounting every month, and I still have to...
deal with my employees.
Yeah. Well, I'm self-employed, yes. But yes, employees. But I still have to, you know, I don't know, like send the proposals out and do the follow-up and... Absolutely. You know.
And I still love it, and I wouldn't trade for anything else.
No, I love the industry. I do. I really...
Me too.
I found... A lot of people say, do you, you know, find your passion or find a hobby, you know, and do a job. And I'm like, you know, yes, wine is my life, but wine really is something I enjoy talking about and learning, because it's more than just, it's not because I drink a lot. It's because of the history and the culture.
Correct.
And the places.
No, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy it. And I enjoy talking with friends. And interesting, you also congregate among people who are into wine as well.
Who was it said, never trust someone who doesn't drink?
Right. Was it Churchill?
He's an alcoholic.
One of those guys. Anyway, Allison, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you. I really
appreciate this conversation. It was wonderful getting your insights.
Thank you.
I learned a lot, and we'll do this again.
I hope so, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure, anytime. And remember, always drink the good stuff. Cheers, everybody.